When I spoke to you about William Carey the other night and the tremendous influence this greatest of Baptist missionaries has had upon the church world, I made the point that I had preached a sermon of Carey's recently in a large Uniting Church gathering in my own church, because William Carey, while he was a Baptist, is bigger than Baptist. William Carey, because of his tremendous influence on the world missionary movement, and through his example directly came the London Missionary Society of the Congregations, the Methodist Overseas Mission, the Church of England Missionary Society, and the China Inland Mission, and a whole range, the African Inland Mission, the Sudan United Mission, Sudan Interior Mission, and all of those great missionary movements grew out of Carey's example. And Carey was bigger than Baptist churches, and he belongs to the heritage of all the churches. And he had insights there that other denominations must learn from in their multicultural and cross-cultural strategies. In the same way, this morning, I want to look at some of the methods of John Wesley. And you might say, well, why are we looking at a John Wesley method and structure when we're good Baptists? And the answer is because you need to. You need to. Because John Wesley was bigger than Methodists. And the greatest tragedy I find about Wesley is that the people who have called themselves by his name have not measured up to the stature of the fullness of John Wesley. And in fact, when I've met in world conferences among the Uniting Church and the Methodist churches of the world, my heart is saddened at the doctrine, at the lack of personal discipline, at the lack of holiness among some people who are of his tradition. The founder is often greater than the people who claim his name. And there were some things about Wesley that I just want to share with you today, because I believe you need to hear some of the things that he had to say and some of the things he did. And I believe there are, I mentioned this yesterday when people were talking about mega churches. Not mega churches, but mega trends that came from Wesley. So the church today must understand. Wesley was converted 50 years before William Carey established the modern missionary movement. And if you understand and can put Carey into the context of the 18th century England, much of what Carey did and the influence upon the Baptists of his time came because of the evangelical revival that was 50 years before William Carey. And much of Carey's life and development and fruit and impetus, which was in the evangelical mould, grew out of the evangelical revival that was established by the Wesleys from the 24th of May 1738, when John Wesley felt his heart strangely warmed. If he had died when he was 36, the world would never have heard of him. And often people wonder, they've reached midlife, halfway between their 70 and 10 years, and wonder what I've accomplished. Everything that Wesley accomplished occurred in the latter half of his life. Just a little bit about the man. His parents were quite remarkable people. Susanna Wesley and her husband Samuel, for 40 years they were Anglican clergy couple. I say a clergy couple because Samuel was a man who tried to climb the hierarchical tree of the ecclesiastical structure. He was down in London at the Union Office more often than he was in his local parish, and the local parish work was left to his wife. She used to visit the sick and care for the needy and conduct funerals. And when he spent a few times in prison, mainly because of failure to pay debt, a problem that clergy have not yet rid themselves of, ask any church bookshop. He went to prison for debt. His wife carried on the ministry in Epworth in his place. And in fact, she was the one that caused quite a revival to begin in his church. An unlettered woman, she took her Bible, opened it, and had in excess of 200 people regularly in her weekly Bible study. She had 19 children and was a great woman of prayer. I was at the Epworth Rectory in England just a few weeks ago, And I might just say that the warden of the rectory, I arrived late in the afternoon and wanted to see through this birthplace of John and Charles Wesley and all the historical memorabilia. And the warden had been painting all day and he was very tired and didn't want me to come. And I said, all right, I'll go back and stay in the Red Hart, which was in Epworth, and come back in the morning. He said, yes, do that, but don't come before nine. And I said, all right. And he said, you're touring round? I said, yes, I've just been up to Thurso. And he said, oh, Thurso. He said, an interesting man came from Thurso. I said, yes, William Alexander Smith. I've just been to Pennyland, the house where he was born. He said, you know about the Boys' Brigade? I said, I'm the national president of the Boys' Brigade in Australia. He said, I'm the Humberside president of the battalion. And so we shook hands with a secret handshake. And he said, come in, you've got to have tea with us tonight. Now, coming from Wesley Church, Sydney, didn't mean a tuppence, but belonging to the Boys' Brigade opened all the doors in the rectory. And he said, you must sleep tonight in Samuel Wesley's bedroom. And I said, do you normally let people come? You know, but you're the president of the Boys' Brigade. So I thought, well, this will be very interesting. Samuel and Susanna's bedroom. I looked at my wife and gave her a wink. I said, 19 children were conceived in that bedroom, you know. So I set myself up for a good night. And when we got into bed, nice, big, old-fashioned feather bed, on the walls were six portraits of John Wesley looking at us. And the one immediately opposite the end of the bed had sort of eyes that followed you wherever you were in the room. Well, I'm not going to bed in Samuel Wesley's bed where 19 children were conceived with him looking at me, so I had to get a towel and hang it over. Susanna and Samuel were quite incredible people, as I mentioned. And Wesley grew up in a family where you think you might get lost in 19 children. Susanna used to get up at 4 a.m. in the morning, and some of you know this well. She didn't have a closet to go and pray in, so she used to take her big apron and put it over her head. And her children knew that when she had the apron over her head, sitting in her kitchen, she was praying to the Lord. And she spent an hour in prayer, and every day of their life prayed for each child individually. And two of her children had world influence and impact. One of the tremendous things that occurred in the life of Wesley early as a child, when he was about 6 years of age, was that he was up in the top story of the garret when the thatched roof caught fire and fell in. And he was unable to get down the stairs. And the house became a blazing inferno at night. And men formed the bucket brigade to try to throw it out. And Samuel Wesley went back and back and heroically brought out sleeping children from the bedroom. But John's bedroom was right at the top and they couldn't get him. And he knelt in prayer and thanked God that he had saved most of his children and committed his son to God's care. And at that moment, a huge mountain of a drunkard of a man from the village arrived. And they put two men on his shoulders. And they reached up through the window where the child was and plucked him out as the roof fell in, literally at the same time, upon his bed. And Wesley described himself as a brand plucked from the burning. God had saved him for a purpose, and that purpose was to tell people of God's love and grace. Traumatic experience in children's lives can have later benefits far beyond what you realise. I never understood that until in the bosom of our own family that sort of thing happened. One of my sons, David, was doing some filming. He was a young guy, always interested when he was about 12 or 13 in electrical goods. In fact, we've often said about the fact that David had an attraction for electricity from the time he was about 8 months old, and he'd pulled out a frying pan, an electric fry pan, from a cupboard, plugged it in, turned it on, and sat in it. And one night, there was a dreadful scream from his bedroom, where he had a whole lot of lights set up, and he was doing some Super 8 movie of little people. He was making moving films by just shifting little characters and so on, and developing a movie interest. And unfortunately, part of the metal framework of the tripod became electrified when one of the wires broke off. And we came in, and he was receiving 240 volts, and already his arm was burnt deeply through the flesh with this frame. And I kicked out the wire, and grabbed a broom and pushed some of the metal away, and he was unconscious, and his heart was stopped, and we resuscitated him and raced him into the Royal North Shore Hospital, where he underwent emergency resuscitation, and he revived. And about 12 hours later, we were with him in the hospital still, and he'd come back, and it was as if his mind was racing at 4,000 miles an hour, and he couldn't stop talking, and he was talking all the time. And he said, "You know, God has saved me in order that I might be a minister and preach his gospel." And coming from a 12-year-old, this was incredible. My wife and I never said anything to him about that, ever. But I wrote it in a diary, which I've kept over all the years. When he was about 17, starting university, he was unsettled and not doing his work well and a nuisance at home. And I thought, I've got to have a talk to this lad. So one day I took him in the car and we just went for a drive. And as we were driving, I said, "David, there's something wrong with you, son. There's a problem you're having with women. Or have you got a problem about sexual identity? Are you having a struggle with relationships? Is it your career? What you talking about, son?" And he said, breaking into tears, "Dad, I've talked to all of my friends, and they've all said I'm right. I feel I'm called to be a minister, like you, Dad. But I don't want to let you down." And I said, "Son, you said that to me once before when you were 12. And I told him the story. And he said, "I said that when I was 12? He couldn't believe it. David happens to be an ordained minister and minister of one of the largest churches of Christ in Australia. He went to the church as a student, and they asked if he could stay on. And so he became youth pastor, and he stayed on. And after a couple of years, they made him associate pastor, and he stayed a couple of years. And then the senior pastor left, and they had a search all round and came to the conclusion that the senior pastor they had was in their staff already. So he was appointed senior pastor, and they appointed a new associate pastor and two more youth workers and an administrator, and he's the youngest of the lot. But he's ministering to God because he felt he was a brand plucked from the burning. And the influence upon small children's lives we ought never overlook." Wesley became a minister. He was quite an academic at Oxford University, became a fellow of Lincoln College. That doesn't mean much here, but I've just spent a couple of months studying in Oxford, and to be a fellow of any college in Oxford is a tremendous professional achievement. But he didn't see his career in academia. He felt the call to take the word of God to people that needed it most, and became an overseas missionary to Georgia, where he's an absolute failure. He came to convert the Indians, he wrote, but oh, who will convert me? He had a torrid love affair because he was a bachelor with a local girl, and in the end he turned his back on her. It was most unwise. Her father was the governor. And eventually returned home. And was back in England as a failure of a missionary, unable to work in as an Anglican clergyman because of this stigma upon him, that he met with a group of Moravian people, and while they were studying the scriptures on a Tuesday night, May the 24th, while it was being opened to him, the scriptures, by Martin Luther's preface to the book of Romans, he said, "I felt my heart strangely warmed, and an assurance was given to me that he had taken away my sins, even mine, and saved me from the law of sin and death." From that moment on, you could not stop him speaking the inexhaustible riches of the gospel of Christ. He was banned very early from preaching in churches, so he started to preach wherever people were. I stood up in one of the villages and said a few words myself recently, because on the cross in the centre of the village square there was just a memorial tablet saying, "From the steps of this cross, John Wesley preached on many occasions as he came through this village." And he would preach in the open air around the marketplaces, at the coal mines. In fact, his greatest crowds were in the great coal mining areas, where he would preach in natural amphitheatres of rock. On one occasion, 24,000 miners and villagers gathered while he preached the gospel, and that was at 5 a.m. in the morning. He used to start his first service around 4 a.m. in the morning, not because he couldn't sleep, but because there were people going to work at that time. So he held services where people were at the time they were available. And to me, that's always an important method within the lessons of the church. Recently we did something in our local church that brought home to me how significant this was. Some of you know that many years ago, 12, 13 years ago, I established a Chinese congregation. I preached for a couple of years and built up this Chinese congregation. Today we have 1,500 people in that particular congregation. And we've just built our new centre and big new car park and everything. I'm walking through the car park, and it's jam-packed full of people at this particular Chinese congregation. And one of the two Chinese ministers in that congregation, Dr. Wilfred Tree, was walking through the car park with me, and I said, "Wilfred, how is it that all of our Chinese people drive Mercedes? There are BMWs and Mercedes here. Aren't there any poor Chinese in Sydney?" He said, "Oh yeah, very many." I said, "Where are the very many poor Chinese?" He said, "Oh, they work in Chinese kitchens." I said, "What do they do in Chinese kitchen?" He said, "Oh, they're kitchen hands. They're mainly illegal and illiterate." And I said, "Most of these illegal and illiterate Chinese that you have in Chinese kitchens, are they Christian?" "Oh, no, they're not Christian." But I said, "They're illegal and they're illiterate. Who's ministering to them?" "Nobody, boss," he said. I said, "Wilfred, I'll tell you what I want you to do. I'm going to take you off most of the work you're doing, and I'll divide your work up among other members of the pastoral staff. And I want you to give 4 or 5 months to visit your illegal and illiterate Chinese." This is the power of a superintendent. So I took Wilfred out of his existing duties, got them done by someone else, and I said, "Now Wilfred, I want you to go and visit all of these poor Chinese. But I want you to go around the lanes of Sydney and go in the back door at the kitchen. Because if you come in the front door, you're going to meet our church members. And they won't let you get to illegal and illiterate members in the kitchen. So go in the back door." So Wilfred went, and he came back after a couple of months, and he said, "How many?" He said, about 450 illegal and illiterates. I said, Wilfred, let's design an outreach program to that hidden people group in Sydney restaurants. So we decided to conduct, this was Wilfred's idea. I would not have started at this point, but Wilfred was smarter than I was on this issue. He said, a lot of these people come from mainland China, and they know house churches, and they're not Christian, but they know what house churches do. So we will have a house church revival. And so we ran an old-fashioned evangelistic meeting singing American hymns in Chinese for a revival meeting which commenced at midnight and ran through to 2 a.m. in the morning. Now, why on earth are we running an evangelistic campaign for Chinese kitchen hands at 2 a.m. in the morning? Exactly. And on a Sunday morning, what are they doing? No, they're not sleeping. They are preparing meals for Christians who go to all the Chinese restaurants after church services. In fact, the only time they really have free is Wednesday afternoon and after midnight. So we conducted a mission from midnight to 2 a.m. and at the end of the week, 26 men had made commitments to Jesus Christ. So we then had a little congregation, which meets on a Wednesday now. That congregation currently averages 220 people and has now established a daughter congregation as of the 1st of July, a daughter congregation of illegal students that we have, and we now have more than 200 in that particular Cantonese-speaking service. The other one, incidentally, happens to be a Mandarin-speaking service, and we now have two Cantonese and one Mandarin-speaking service. But once you get illegal immigrants, the first thing you've got to do is work on their status. So I went to the government and I said, I've got 200 illegal immigrants, I will tell you their names if you'll grant them an amnesty. And if you don't grant them an amnesty, I'm not going to tell you their names. And we had a little bit of coming and going, and eventually, in order to tidy up the system, they were granted an amnesty, and almost all of them were granted permanent residency status. They are now legal citizens. Then we had to start language classes. Our English language classes start at 5 a.m. Saturday morning, because again, that's when they're available. I'm learning from John Wesley. Be available when the people are available. And they go to work at 6:30, so we start at 5 a.m. in the morning, and we have English language classes from 5 a.m. to about 6 a.m. every Saturday morning. And the people now learning English. Then we start job skill training programs. Because you don't want to be a kitchen hand all your life. Very low pay, very hard work. So we train them to be chefs. Now, you kitchen hands over here, I want to see you lot upwardly and we'll run a job training program and turn you into chefs, if you like. And that's exactly what we do. So these people don't stay as kitchen hands, but they can get better jobs. They are now legal residents. They can marry. They are learning English. They've got job skills. And they're part of the Christian church. They can now have bank accounts. They can now buy a car. And when you convert a man, you just don't convert part of his life. You may have to convert all of his life, including his relationship with the government, with the and all of this. So John Wesley taught us to go after people at the times when they're available. And the remarkable thing about Wesley is that he rode his horse up and down England and Scotland and Wales and over to Ireland, constantly travelling over quarter of a million miles by horseback. He preached 40,000 sermons. He preached at, on an average of about 8 times every day, starting early in the morning. And he would stop wherever his horse would stop and gather whoever would listen to the gospel of Christ. He personally led 140,000 people to Jesus Christ. A great evangelist. By the time of his death, there were more than 200,000 people in Bible study groups, he called societies and classes, all over England. And one of the tremendous things that come home to me is that when he gathered together half a dozen converts, he would encourage one of them to pastor that little group of people. And more frequently than not, the pastor was a woman. And more frequently than not, the woman became enormously faithful as she struggled to understand the scriptures. The problem was that so few of them could read. So they thought, how can we teach our people the great doctrines of faith if they can't read? Wesley was a great scholar, but the people were ignorant. How can you describe the incarnation? Our God contracted to a span, incomprehensibly made man. Put it into poetry. Because people remember rhymes. Hickory dickory, the mouse ran up the... Where did you learn that? How do you remember it? The intelligence of Queensland Baptist. But if you put it into simple rhyme, people remember it. And what's even better, if you go down to the pubs, where the ordinary people were in those days, the only place where ordinary people could gather, they used to sing their songs. So he took their popular tunes and put Christian words to them and said, and can it be that I should gain an interest in my Saviour's blood? Died he for me, who him to death pursued? Amazing love! How can it be that thou, my God, shouldst die for me? And his brother Charles wrote hymns to teach doctrine. It was a method, it was a strategy, and it used the popular tunes. I tell you, the Wesleys were far ahead of the church of these days. We will use the popular tunes of Wesley's day, but we won't use the popular tunes of our day. Wesley's message was simple: God's grace. And the older I get, the more I want to preach about the love of God and the grace of God. Personal salvation through faith in Jesus Christ, who redeems us from our sins. A spirit-filled life. It's of no accident that all of the Pentecostal charismatic influences stressing the influence of the Spirit grew out of Wesleyan roots, because he emphasized the Spirit-filled life. Transformed lives are needed to transform society. And finally, a social care is needed for people. It's not enough just to convert your Chinese kitchen hands and say, go back to your kitchen, be well fed and warmed. If you convert a man, you've got the whole of his life. It may be his language, his immigrant status, his personal relationship, but the whole of life has to be altered. And John Wesley made sure that the poor were helped in incredible ways. The first church they ever set up was in a factory. Sounds familiar to some churches in these days? Going into factories and large public buildings and schools. That's where they established their churches. It seated 1,500 people. He got rid of pews, because pews used to be hired on pew rents. And they put in forms so that ordinary people could sit. And for the first time, said in church, you can sit anywhere you wanted. They opened the Lord's table to people. Opened a free school with 60 children in their first week. Started education classes for the poor people, a shelter for widows. Established a dispensary to give medicines, free medicines to the poor. Built a cafeteria so families could come and eat together. In fact, that was the model after which we built our own Wesley Centre. When he used to go into some villages, the clergy were always suspicious of this horse-riding itinerant evangelist. And over again he used to write to people words such as these: "We will not disturb your congregation. The rich, the honourable and the great, we leave to you. Only let us serve the poor, the vulgar, the base and the outcasts." And he had a call to that. You know, one of the tragedies of most of our denominations is that you convert people and they become decent and settled and motivated and purpose-driven, and they become upwardly mobile and middle class, and they drive Mercedes, GL Falcons, automatic, and we forget the poor. And John Wesley reminds me to get back to the poor. I want to just spend a moment speaking briefly about his methods. His principle was to restore New Testament Christianity, to try to find the Christianity of the Bible and bring it into local churches. Now, every one of us would agree with that. To take the principles and practices of the New Testament, because the Anabaptists, your predecessors, were basically restorationists. Restore the practices and principles of the early church. But he was always an Anglican all of his life. And every year he preached in Oxford. And he always hoped to convert the Anglican church. Wesley was never a Methodist. The Methodist church only came into being after his death. Incidentally, they were called Methodists because of their practice of being so methodical in studying the Bible and personal prayer and discipline on their life. But the interesting thing is, I remind Methodists around the world that 100 years before John Wesley, a group of Anabaptists were called Methodists in a sneering fashion, in the same way as Wesley was, for being so methodical in the study of the Scriptures. There are more things akin between Wesley and Baptists than many of you realise. But, says some character up the back, why didn't he practice immersion baptism? Because even in the best of men, there are blinkers, and our culture stops us seeing what the New Testament teaches. Otherwise, why haven't Baptist churches the practice of remembering the Lord at the table of communion on the first day of every week, as is the New Testament practice, as was the example of the early church? If you ever want to talk about someone not baptizing by immersion, start asking if you're following the example of weekly communion. Sometimes all of us have blinkers when it comes to looking at the Scriptures. I'm glad to say, incidentally, there is a rather heretical and radical movement in the Uniting Church led by the Theological College and the lecturers, called the Society for the Weekly Observance of Holy Communion. Even churches have blinkers. He not only wanted to restore New Testament Christianity, but he wanted to renew the church. And I won't spend longer on that, but that was one of his principles of church renewal, by changing the lives of ordinary believers. A third was spiritual discipline, so that everybody was in the habit of daily prayer, of daily grace between meals, of daily Bible study. Interesting, the urban poor of England responded to that in the most incredible way. And Wesley's famous statement that has motivated me for years and years in Churches of Christ ministry was, "Go not to those who need you, but go to those who need you most." He would research the methods. In fact, John Whitfield, one of his friends and reporters and supporters, found that by preaching in the open air, he could get to the common man. And John Wesley said, "I would think it a sin if I preached the gospel not in a pulpit." But
Whitfield showed that in the open air people would respond to the gospel. And so he changed his method. It's always the sign, I think, of a great Christian to use new methods. And he became, of course, the greatest of all open air preachers. I always remember at a dinner I had when the speaker was J. Edwin Orr, that great evangelist and the man who was the authority on revival more than any other person in the 20th century, was with us at Wesley one time doing a series of meetings, and at a dinner one night he said, "Now there is in Epworth the old rectory. The first time I took a group of students there was in 1941 at the outbreak of the war. I took a group of American students from Wheaton College and I took them through the old rectory at Epworth, and I said this was where the Wesleys grew up and so on, and I showed them each of the room, and we came out and the students all tumbled back in the bus and we're just going off, and 38, 39, 41 missing. Went back to find the students still there. And beside John Wesley's bed, visitors are shown two indentations or grooves in the wood of the floorboards. And it was said they were worn there by the knees of John Wesley in his hours of prayer. And he went back and one of the students was kneeling in these kneel holes and praying on the bed. And he was praying, Lord, do it again. Do it again. And J. Edwin Orr said, I stood beside the student in the bed. This tall, long, lanky American student from Wheaton. And I put my hand on his shoulders and said, we've got to go now, son. Come on, Billy. And Billy Graham stood and went and joined the bus. The connection between the Wesleys and the Baptists are closer than some of you realize. John Wesley's life was modeled around two verses, and I leave them with you. The two verses come from Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. Over and over again he preached on these verses. From the NIV, therefore I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercies, offer your body as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. And do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to approve what God's will is, his good and pleasing and perfect will. Those verses became central to the life of John and Charles Wesley. I mentioned to you the other night the significance of therefore. And this verse starts with therefore. There are four great therefores, each starting to this point of the 12th chapter, a new segment in the book of Romans. There was the therefore of condemnation. We read it in chapter 3, verse 20. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in the sight of God by observing the law. It's a therefore of condemnation. In chapter 5, 1, there is the great therefore of justification. Therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God. And then in chapter 8, 1, there's a therefore of assurance. Therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And then in 12:1, you've got the therefore of obedience and of dedication. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, by the mercy of God, give your life as a holy, acceptable sacrifice. Just let me say three things about it. Give to God your body as a living sacrifice. It's his temple, his spirit wants to dwell in it. We must give our bodies to God to be used in his service. Paul says, and give him your minds as well. The world controls the mind of too many Christians. And Paul says, don't be conformed to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. God doesn't want conformists in the church. Transformists. People who will change and change for the better. And then finally, give to God your will. Many people think that they control their own will power, but they usually fail. We need a disciplined life where our will, not mine, but thine, be done. If you begin every day with prayer, and if you have the disciplined personal life that John Wesley talked about, then I think you've come in line with his will, which is good and perfect for you. Wesley used to write in his diary, at the end of every day, his diaries are the most fascinating spiritual reading. And on every day, he used to write at the bottom, he'd been to this village and that place and this marketplace and around the ironworks of this factory. And he used to write, we offered Christ. It's the loveliest sentence. And in all that we do, we're called to be fully dedicated to him, of body, mind and will, so that to other people we might simply offer Christ.